Mr. President, I thank you for your presence with us tonight. It's good to have each of you who come. Those from Tucson, and of course, Brother Mick is with us tonight from Durango, Colorado, for which we're thankful and glad the Lord's blessed him with a good trip. Glad to have Jim here, too, of course, from Oklahoma, and we respect him, of course, but we're thankful that he has come and is with us. We have some very interesting things to talk about tonight, as far as I'm concerned, and I think that the entire study on Daniel Revelation is extremely intriguing, and of course, I'm thoroughly enjoying it. As I have mentioned to you a time or two already, I am here to learn as well as I trust you are. Your coming is encouraging to me because you're showing interest, you're taking notes, and you're coming out of tonight. And for that, I think there's a good indication you are concerned. And I hope that you learn, but as I mentioned to you already, I always learn when I go through these studies. And almost every time, if not every time, I learn something that I didn't know before. I can either go deeper into it or see some things I just absolutely did not see before. And that's the way, of course, it should be. And that's the intriguing fact about these books and about God's insight in these matters. So I'm constantly looking forward to learning. And I said that to say this. Last night, something was brought to my attention that I had never caught before. And looking today and last night, whether Jim and myself did quite a bit of studying last night for a couple of hours, delving into the question that was raised, and I'm thoroughly pleased with the question being asked, or the observation being made, and for the opportunity to delve into it. I would not have noticed this otherwise. Brother Ken Roberts last night asked if there might be some significance to a verse that I simply passed over just in casual mentioning, didn't go into it. He said, in effect, that you mentioned a time being a year, and that there are other equations and evaluations in Bible prophecy where a day stands for a year, or there's some other terminology. If, for an example, a day stands for a year, then what would a month be? Of course, that'd be 30 years. Well, what would other measurements be? So, in Daniel 7, verse 12, where we looked last night, it says, as concerning the rest of the beast, we've been talking about the dreadful and terrible beast, and this, of course, we have mentioned was being Rome. And on this chart to your right, you'll see that we have, as we have discussed already, chapters 2 and 7 outlined on the board as far as the summary of it's concerned. Tonight, we'll be talking about chapter 8. And then on the far right is the evaluation of these things in world history. Now, we have mentioned that the gold, the silver, the brass, the iron, are the lion, the bear, the leopard, and the dreadful and terrible. And tonight we're going to talk about two more of the same things we've talked about already, but they're taken from a different point of view, and one is the ram, the other is he-go. We've shown that they are represented by Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. We've shown that each of these had a certain duration of time they were to exist, and the time is also mentioned on the right-hand side of the board. But in verse 12 of chapter 7, talking about the long extension of the dreadful and terrible beast and how long he would be able to be a source or problem to God and his purposes, it says, are the others that we've talked about. As concerned the rest of the beast, this, of course, would be speaking of the ones that were not then under consideration, they had their dominion taken away. Yet, their lives were prolonged for a season and time. So, Brother Ken said, since time would be in a year, then how many seasons are there in a year? I didn't really know what he was getting to, except I knew there were four seasons in a year, and so we discussed, yes, there were four. If a year, then, is 360 days, and there are four seasons in a year, then one season would be one-fourth of what a year was, or 90 days. Now, if that's the case, one year and a time are the same, and then 90 days or 3 months would be one season of four that's normally occurring in a year, then what is a season and a time? Well, a time then, if you allow a time to be a year, and you have 12 months in it, or 30 days each, that would be 360 days. Thus, if we have time being 360 years, and a fourth of that, a season, being 90 years, it would amount to 450 years, or day years, as prophecy should be spoken. Now, Brother Ken, does that pretty well put it like you had it in mind? Okay. I had never seen that before. Of course, the words were there. I've seen those. But I had never seen behind that something significant. And I'm inclined to think there might be. So thank you. And the same thing's true of all of us. We're here to study. We're here to learn. I'm here to learn. And in 20 years of studying this, I constantly learn. I would like to learn some more things this week. I don't know yet. I'm thankful for it. Now let's see what that might mean. We went back into some history books I had with me. There are others that we can go farther on. And the best we can determine is that if you go back to the very beginning of Babylonia. Now, I know, and if you look in your history books, particularly the Americana or the Encyclopedia Britannica or some of those very deep encyclopedias, you'll likely notice that there was an ancient kingdom called Babylon, and there was the Nebuchadnezzar. Now, of course, that's a matter of history we all know. But that was way in the past. And we're not talking about that time. Now, we're talking about the second Babylonian empire. The first king of that empire, and they were under the rule of the Assyrians, and he rebelled against the Assyrians, and he came on the scene just ahead of Nebuchadnezzar. His name was Nebuchadnezzar. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, as far as we are able to determine from our books last night, and the word about is used in these books. And it says he came and made the rebellion in about 620. So if you will, just use 620. I'd really like for that to be 618, but since the book said 620 instead of about, I'm going to use what it said. So 620 is the date, B.C. Now, Nineveh was defeated in 606, and of course Jerusalem was defeated too in 606, as you know from our studies. And then Babylon falls to Persia, and that was in 539. And then Medo-Persia falls to Greece in 131, as we have it on the board over here. And then Greece falls to Rome in 168, as we have it on the board. Now, if you go from 620 down to 168, encompassing these kingdoms that preceded Rome, that's exactly what it said, as concerning the rest of the beast, not Rome now, as concerning the rest of the beast, they had their dominion taken away. Yet their lives were prolonged for a season in time. Now, if a season in time is 450 years, then what we have covered here is 452 years. And we're not certain about that 620, because the historians didn't know the exact date to put there. And that's almost exactly the number of years. So I'm thrilled. It looks like we have something here that I had noticed, and thank you very much for bringing it to our attention. Something was mentioned in the prayer about my speaking and about my message. Well, I appreciate the fact that I can be here, and you've allowed me to come, and I feel honored to be able to speak about these matters. But as John says in Revelation, he was a penman, Christ was a spokesman, God was the author. I'd love to think that what we're talking about tonight is God's Word. And I'm so thrilled that we had the opportunity to look into it, and I'm honored to be here. And thank you very much for your coming and being with us. Our study tonight is from the 8th chapter of Daniel. I hope we can get through chapter 9, because tomorrow we need to complete chapters 10, 11, 12. So if you will, sometime tomorrow, read chapters 10, 11, and 12 before you come tomorrow night. And we'll try to have spent this time on Daniel and then proceed on the next night into Revelation. We'll need a great deal of time on Revelation, and I hope we can complete this by tomorrow night. We know now that we have talked about chapters 2 and chapter 7 as insight to the various kingdoms which were to come on the scene and which were in some way to have relationship to God's people. We have discussed the fall of Babylonia. We have discussed the fall of Medo-Persia and the coming of Greece. And then we have looked in the possibility of the coming of Rome, but we haven't seen that yet in our studies. And we won't in the book of Daniel as a fact is concerned. Now, we'll see it in prophecy, but not as a fact. But he tells us now tonight about these matters, beginning with verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which first appeared to me at first. So Daniel has in mind now another vision that he's seeing. And he says it was in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar. I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was in Shushan, in the palace which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, and I was by the river of Eliah. Now you remember the other night when we talked about chapter 5, we said that Daniel, for some reason, was not known by Belshazzar. Now he's talking about the reign of Belshazzar now. And the other night, Belshazzar seemed not to have remembered him. But the mother, or the queen, probably the queen mother, because Belshazzar likely was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar is the one who saw this awful image and who had to eat the grass, you remember, out in the field, and had to go through the things that we already discussed. He well knew Daniel, as you well know from our study. But Belshazzar, his grandson, did not. Now we wonder why. Why he didn't know about Daniel. Well, this we alluded to. Tonight you have seen Daniel during the third year of Belshazzar. Now he reigned 4 years. And I don't know how long he was there, but Daniel apparently was not where Belshazzar was. The reason we see this is because it says, I was in the palace in Shushan and the province of Elam. Now, likely we're talking about Persepolis, which was the ancient kingdom of these people, and which is lying in ruins today. In fact, it goes back a long, long, long time. But whatever the case is, he was somewhere apparently away from the where the king was, and was not fully aware of all these matters that Nebuchadnezzar was. But whatever the case, that's a possibility. We don't know that for a fact, but we know that he was not always present. He was not there when Nebuchadnezzar apparently threw. He was apparently not there when he threw Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego into the fire, because had he been there, he would have been just like them and apprehended and thrown into the fire too. And he wasn't there. So Daniel apparently served in a very wonderful way for the kings and those in authority, and apparently traveled in that work. Verse 3 says, Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram, which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward. Now, if we see a ram, and he's coming from the directions we can deduct from this, we see he's coming from an area that will help us pinpoint where the next situation arises, which prophecy brings to our mind. Notice, first of all, this was a ram. He had two horns. Now, the fact that one horn came up after the other lets us know that of this two-horned ram, there was going to be one part of it that would arise prior to the other. And that's absolutely what history tells you. Now, again, if you want to do some checking, I wish you would, one of the very good sources is the Botanical Encyclopedia. Another one that is not quite as good, I don't think, is the Americana. And third would be the World Book. But the World Book does have some very good information about these matters. The Encyclopedia Judaica, which is a Jewish encyclopedia, is also very, very good on these matters, very large and very deep. Each of those are, plus a number of other history books. And there are some good ones around, but most of the time I found the ancient history books. And those which were written quite some time ago and not the modern books are usually far, far better on the details and tying these things together than the modern books. There seems to be a change of direction in our modern writers and modern books. But they'll tell you some things about this which are very interesting, and that is that Media was on the scene as an aggressive, growing empire prior to Persia. But they were related, they were connected. In fact, at one time, they were under control of Assyria. But now Assyria gets pushed aside, and Babylon takes over the scene, and then Media begins to emerge. And as the Media emerges with its prominence and its ability to control, very soon they lose out. And the Persians take over the Median influence, and while they're the same people and have the same outlook and the same background, the Persians seem to predominate, and that's where this second horn comes in. The Median seem to lose out the control, and the Persians take over. That has to do something, perhaps, with our nation as opposed to England. England was our father nation. And then in time, the English influence lost out, particularly through our American Revolution, and then we became a separate people and eventually a more powerful people than England. That's maybe not a good illustration, but to give you an idea anyway. So Median came up first, and then after them, Persia, and they began to be a dominant power over the Medians and the Persians. So the Persians now are the ones on the scene, and Cyrus is the man in particular we look at as being the man of power. Verse 4 says, I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward. Now, if the ram is pushing to the west, and to the north, and to the south, it must mean he's coming from the east. Therefore, if this be the case, we notice then that the next power on the scene is going to come from the east. And that helps us understand in world history what to look for as being the next subject to consider. So that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will, and became great. And I was considering, behold, a he-goat came from the west. So, we have a power coming from the east, which of course is Media and Persia. Then we have another power coming from the west, which is Greece, as you'll see in a few moments. Now, that's what the map would show you. That's what Daniel has told you. And that's what world history tells you. So we have a pretty good picture now of what's going on. Now, this he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. I think that would let us understand that here is power, here is strength, here is a determination, here is speed. Because you don't see him lagging around. He doesn't hesitate. He's not hindered by having to have contact with the ground. He is a fast-moving force, and indeed it was, because here's Alexander. He comes on the scene. He's only 33 years old when he dies. He conquers the entire world in 11 years. So we have here a very speedy movement coming, and that's exactly what history tells us, from the west. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. So the ram has two horns. The goat has one horn. The ram's horns are descriptive of something, and likewise, this one is too, because the horn on this goat is a predominant horn, and it is a single horn, and it's a great horn. But he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran into him in the fury of his power. So Greece hits head-on Persia and Media, and controls it, and conquers it, and subdues it. And I saw him come close with the ram. He was moved with choler, or fury, against him, and smote the ram and broke his two horns. So that shows that Greece now conquers Persia. And there was no power in the ram to stand before the goat, but he cast him down the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. So Persia is defeated, Persia is gone, and now Greece becomes the power of the world. You can see that on the board because we've already talked about it earlier. Daniel's mentioned it twice before. Here's the third time. So apparently he's trying to confirm what he said, and God lets him do that. Therefore the goat waxed, and the word wax means grew. Therefore the goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. So Greece now has one notable horn. Of course, this is Alexander. But when he has become victorious and powerful, and you remember last night in world history will tell you, that when Alexander was 33 years old, he was a very smart person as far as intelligence is concerned. He was very aggressive. He certainly commanded attention, but he also was a hard drinker. He was a very violent man. And as he was coming back from India with his forces, he was very drunk, and he developed a fever, and he died at a very young age. And when he died, of course, the generals of his army desired to know who was to be in control. And just before he died, as I mentioned to you last night, they asked him who was to take control. And he said, in effect, he who is able. Simply meaning he had appointed nobody. And there would be a contest between his generals as to who would be now the one to succeed him. Well, notice here in verse 8, Daniel tells us what's going to happen. And for that great horn that was broken came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. So here we have four generals who take over the Grecian powers, and they divided among themselves into four parts. Out of one of them came forth a little horn. So we have now four horns, and now from those four we see another little horn emerge, which waxed or grew exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the present land. So you have the south, and you have the east, and then in between you have the pleasant land. Now, what's the pleasant land? Well, the words pleasant land were used in the Old Testament several times. They were used to refer to the land of God's people. David talks about this in the book of Psalms, and others do, about the pleasant land. No doubt this refers to the land of God's people, which is between now, and it was then, the north, or the east, rather, and the south. Now, what was east from the area we're looking at? Of course, you're talking about Syria. And what is south? You're talking about Egypt. So right between Egypt and Syria, you have a path that was worn out almost, trodden over and over and over again by this little horn. We're going to talk about him tonight, and again, Lord willing, tomorrow night as well. And we find that he did cast down some of the host of the stars to the ground and stamp upon them. Verse 10. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression. Now, by these words, you can envision now some catastrophe taking place. You're talking about sacrifices, you're talking about transgressions, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. So here we have a force which is going to be opposed to God's people and his purposes, and they're going to trample them under feet. And I heard one saint speaking, and that another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden under foot? So Daniel hears this question asked, how long is this going to be? What time span do we look at? And he said unto me, until 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Now notice, the sanctuary has been polluted in the verses we just talked about. The sacrifice is taken away, he's trampled underfoot, God's holy people are destroyed and harmed and scattered. And then he says now, but 2,300 days, there's going to be a cleansing of the temple, and things are going to be restored. And it came to pass, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then, behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. Angels do that sometime. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man, make Daniel, to understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell upon my face. But he said unto me, understand, O Son of God, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Now, when we speak about the time of the end, it's very easy for some people to jump to conclusions and say, oh, that's the end of time, that's the end of the world. Well, don't do that too often, because in Daniel and Revelation, the time of the end very rarely talks about the end of time. Did you see the twist of words? The time of the end does not mean the end of time. Now, the time of the end simply means the end of whatever is under consideration at that time. So, we're not talking about the end of time. We're talking about the end of these two animals that's under consideration, Persia and Greece. So, that's what we're speaking about. We're talking about when this particular situation comes to an end. In prophecy, it's very easy for a person to take something out of its context. That simply means to lift it out of where it is, and apply it where it looks like it'll fit. I've heard people talk about helicopters because the Bible very plainly pictures helicopters. And it talks about the firing of guns from the rear. And we have all kinds of things pictured in Revelation if you just listen to somebody talk about it. And you can prove just about anything you want to by it if you let them take it out of the setting. But put it back in its setting. Let it stay where it belongs and look at it from the point of view of what surrounds it. You'll see very clearly it's talking about that time and that day and that age. And it's not talking about the end of time. So again, the time of the end does not mean the end of time. It means the time at which what's under consideration comes to an end, or a fullness, or a completeness. So we find that whatever that we're talking about, whatever happens, is going to be 2,300 days. Now, as he was speaking with me, verse 18, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground, but he touched me and set me upright. And he said, behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation. For at the time appointed, the end shall be. So the indignation is what we're talking about, and the end of the indignation. Now, we're going to call this an abomination later on. The ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. And the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now, watch this closely. In the very first verse it says, in effect, that they were living during the time of the Babylonian Empire, because Belshazzar was the last king and he was there on the throne. So we're talking about Babylonia. And who in their wildest imagination would even dream of the fact that one year from there, Babylonia, the great world empire, was going to crumble and fall and Media Persia would conquer it. And then who would even dream that 100 years, 150 years later, Greece would come on the scene and conquer Persia? Nobody would even thought of such a thing as that. But you see, Daniel said it would happen. Told us the name of these kingdoms that would arise. So we're talking about something that God has seen fit to reveal to us. Very evident that God's the author of this book, and certainly Daniel didn't know that without inspiration. And this proves emphatically that God is a God who can tell us, see the future, and a God to fear and to love and to admire and to respect and adore. Verse 22 says, "Now that being broken, whereas four horns stood up for it," talking about the horn that was broken, "four kingdoms shall stand out of the nation, but not in his power." So the nation now has lost its great power in Alexander. And now four horns or four kings are going to stand up. The kingdom will be divided four ways, but it will have lost its impact. And, of course, it's headed for doom. "And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to a full," when the Grecians now have come to the extent that God will let them go, "then all the damage that they can do, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up." So there's going to emerge now another king. Now this other king is the little horn. You see, we have the four horns that have come up instead of Alexander. And then verse 9 says, "A little horn to come up among the four." Now, this one that we're talking about now, the transgressors are come to a full. Then a king, the little horn, among the four, a little king, is going, a fierce countenance, is going to stand up. He's going to understand dark sentences. This wording seems to indicate that it's something unpleasant. It's ungodly. It's not to be desired. So you say nothing good about this, and it's not. "And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy wonderfully." Now the word wonderfully here does not mean it's a marvelous, beautiful, lovely thing. He talks about the glory of harm and sin, and power and majesty of it. He's not talking for a moment about something good. "He shall destroy wonderfully and shall prosper in practice." Notice this. "And shall destroy the mighty and holy people." So whoever this is going to work against God's people, not for them. "And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart." I guess I'd better stop right there, because I want to tell you something about this man, lest I forget it. This man who's coming on the scene is going to have a name, which he's going to call himself. It's going to be Epiphanes, and some pronounce it Epiphanes. But whatever pronunciation you use, that means the illustrious one. who was it? Muhammad Ali. You remember him? Back in, he was Cassius Clay. "I'm the greatest," you remember? I couldn't stand him. But anyway, he came on the television, he bragged about it. He was the greatest. Nobody in the world was better than he was. He was it. He boasted, he bragged. Now, that's what this fellow's going to do. He's a king. He's going to be one of the successors of the king of Greece. Indeed, he had an illustrious background, but he was a sad lot for a man. No principle about him at all. And so he calls himself the illustrious one. But if you'll take the name Epiphanes, and you'll leave out the PH and put an M in place of the PH, as some of his soldiers did, they called him the madman. So they had a different idea of the illustrious one than he did. But that's who he called himself, and that's how he's known in history. "He shall also stand up against the prince of princes." Now, who would that be? "But he shall be broken without hand." A very good description, which we'll see in a moment. "And the vision of the evening, the morning, which was told, is true. Wherefore, shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days." Daniel is told now that's not going to happen soon. It'll be in the future. In fact, it was going to be after Daniel died, and so he wouldn't see these things. "And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days. Afterward, I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it." You see, Daniel didn't understand what he was talking about. Now, that doesn't mean that God didn't speak to him and didn't tell him what God wanted him to know. He did. The fact is, visions and dreams and prophecy are not to be understood until the time comes that God wants them to be understood. So, Daniel said these things. These things are written. These things have been in world history since the middle of the 5th century B.C. 6th century B.C. 550, so to speak. But the fact is, it was not ready to be revealed until some time later. Now we can look back in history and we can see the exact time these things happened, exactly what he was talking about. Now, as we can look back now and see in history those things, so in the future we're going to be able, as we study on and on and on, look back through history and see what God wanted us to know as the things came to pass which he intended. Now, having discussed that chapter, let's go back and see very quickly, if possible, some of the things we have talked about. Beginning with about verse 20, we find that there were two powers on the scene. There was Media and there was Greece. Alexander died in 323 B.C., and four horns or four kingdoms stood in his place. Last night, we mentioned who those four were. And those four were Cassander, who took control of Greece proper, Lashmus, who took Asia Minor, and Seleucus, who took Assyria, including Babylon, and Ptolemy, who took control of Egypt. Now, those four directions from Greece proper is the way that the kingdom of Greece was divided. And then it says, verse 23, in latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to a full, a king of fierce countenance shall stand up. So this was not going to happen immediately. It was going to happen sometime after the kingdom was divided into four parts. And sure enough, some little while after that, it did take place. Now, verses 24 through 25 tell us a little bit more about that as we read. It talks to us about his power and about what he's going to do. And so the focus of attention, though, goes now away from the four horns and the four divisions unto this one person who rises. Now, tomorrow night, Lord willing, we're going to talk about who he affected, who he had war with, what took place, and a number of things about him, because Daniel goes into that in our study tomorrow night. But for tonight, we're able to identify who the man is, show where he's coming from, and some little bit about him, so we know more about this man, which the Lord wants us to know in this particular chapter. What happens is that there was going to be some things about the temple, and about the worship of God's people, and about those things which surrounded that, he was going to bring to utter destruction, and he's going to be illustrated now as a man of great harm against God and his people. In due time, after he had done much harm and had been very wicked and evil and sinful, he went down into Egypt, and he was successful in battling against the Pharaoh. There was conflict now between Egypt and Syria, which is where this man is. You see, they began to go back and forth through the land of Jerusalem and Palestine and God's people between Egypt and Syria. We're going to read that tomorrow night in much, much more detail. But tonight, suffice to know, we have the Pharaoh and Egypt consideration, and we have this man here, Antiochus, under consideration. Now, when you talk about a man whose name is Antiochus, you very well know that when you look at this word closely, you're going to see there were some cities named after him or his family. You had Antioch up in Turkey. You had Antioch north of Jerusalem, just like you have Caesarea on the course north and west of Jerusalem. So like we today have many towns named after people like Jackson or Washington and some prominent men. So in those days you did too. And that's where Antioch got his name, from this family of the Antiochuses. So Antiochus Epiphanes is the man we have in mind now. And the story which is told of his returning back from Egypt is that there was a report made in Jerusalem and around Jerusalem that he had died. And there was a great deal of joy and celebration over the fact this man had died. He was such an awful fellow. And so when he returns, we are reading from a man whose name is Ironside. He is a very good historian. He has written a book about the age between Malachi and Matthew, and the age which, of course, Daniel's predicting. Daniel talks about some things in his prophecy that we don't have in Bible history. There's 400 silent years, roughly, there, and you have to go to secular history to find out what they were. We're going to read some of those tonight. This particular man's very good. He lived a number of years ago. He writes about what took place. He says that he assaulted Jerusalem with wrathful energy, took the city by storm, upon which followed a fearful sack and carnage. Over 40,000 persons were slain in 3 days, and an equal number torn from their homes and led away as captives. Nor was this all. Guided by the wretched apostate Menelaus, he forced his way into the holiest of all. Now, you know that that is the section of the temple, which was behind everything else out front, so that only once a year the high priest went, And he offered sacrifice for himself and the sins of the people. And it's behind this veil, symbolically, that Christ went in his death and took away the sins of the whole world. So the holiest of all was, of course, the most sacred part of the temple. So he found his way back into the sacred of the holiest of all, carried off the golden candlestick, the table, the incense altar, and other vessels, destroyed the books of the law, and set up the abomination of desolation. Now, there is an abomination spoken of here. However, this is not what Christ speaks of when he speaks of the abomination of desolation. I'll get to that in a moment. By erecting an idol altar upon the holy altar of burnt offerings, upon which he sacrificed a great sow. You know what sow is? I don't like that word. It means a big, fat mother pig. And that's exactly what God did not want. Exactly contrary to everything God had ordained, there was not to be pig meat eaten. And yet they're offering this now to a false god on the altar which had been used for sacrifices for the true God. And with a broth made of its unclean flesh, sprinkled and defiled all the temple. Now this, as you'll notice in a moment, is 2 years prior to what I'm going to read to you in a moment. And that'll give us a time schedule that you need to see. I think you can see that when you study prophecy, you don't just read something and let it drop right there. There's a great deal of research has to go into it. And world history is a key to it. So that's the very key to understanding prophecy. And these 2 years will be important in just a moment as you see. This is what happened now when Epiphanes hears a false report about his death. People are in joy. He comes back toward his home and he literally destroys the temple and things that were going on there at the time. He heard the false message. However, he comes back in 2 years, or sends one of his leaders back in 2 years, and he does things that are even worse than that, if it could be. But I want you to remember the first reference I had made, because that was in the year 171 B.C. Now, what I'm going to read to you of now takes place 2 years later. I'm going to say 168. Because I don't have the exact month there. It looks like 3 years, but it's not. It's just into the third, beyond the second year. So here we have 168 in consideration as I read. It came to pass after 2 years, in the 140th and 5th year of the 25th day of that month, which is by us called Casheliu, and this is the same as our December, and by the Macedonians at Pelos in the 153rd Olympiad, that the king came up to Jerusalem, and, pretending peace, he got possession of the city by treachery, at which time he spared not so much as those that admitted him into it, on account of the riches that lay in the temple, but led by his covetous inclination, for he saw there was in it a great deal of gold, and many ornaments that had been dedicated to it of very great value, and in order to plunder its wealth, he ventured to break the league he had made. By treachery this is done. He's not honest. Does not have any honor whatsoever about him, as you'll read from history. Now remember now, this is on December the 25th, 168 B.C., as we know the date. So he left the temple bare and took away the golden candlesticks and the golden altar of incense and table of showbread and the altar of burnt offering, and did not abstain from even the veils, which were made of fine linen and scarlet. He also emptied it of its secret treasures and left nothing at all remaining, and by this means cast the Jews into great lamentation, for he forbade them to offer those daily sacrifices which they used to offer to God according to the law. Now I want you to get that. I'm reading from Josephus. This is in his Antiquities, this book 12, chapter 5, and section 4. Now, if you didn't get that, we'll give it to you later on. Antiquities of Josephus, book 12, chapter 5, section 4. This is a book that was written by a man who was on the scene almost, not quite, because he was outside the city and had been captured at the time of 70 A.D. when Jerusalem was captured. He went to Rome, and there is some slight indication that he might well have become a Christian. Nobody really knows, because it doesn't mention much about it, but it does talk about Christ in this book. And if you want to read this, you'd love it. And it's hard reading. but you'd love to see the truths it contains. But the point is, he now tells us that what happened is they took away those daily sacrifices. Exactly what Daniel said would happen. And Daniel said this over 500 years before this man wrote. And now he tells us that's what took place, writing about historical facts. And when he had pillaged this whole city, some of the inhabitants he slew. And some he carried captive together with their wives and children, so that the multitude of those captives that were taken alive amounted to about 10,000. He also burnt down the finest buildings, and when he had overthrown the city walls, he built a citadel in the lower part of the city, for the place was nigh and overlooked the temple, on which account he fortified it with great high walls and towers, and put into it a garrison of Macedonians. However, in that citadel dwelt the impious and wicked part of the Jewish multitude, from whom it proved that the citizens suffered many and sore calamities. When the king had built an idol altar upon God's altar, he slew swine upon it, and so offered a sacrifice neither according to the law nor the Jewish religious worship in that country. He also compelled them to forsake the worship which they paid to their own God, and to adore those whom he took to be gods, to make them build temples and raise idol altars in every city and village, and offer swine upon them every day. Now that's what he's done against God and the temple and those things related to it, violation of the law. But read a little farther. He also commanded them not to circumcise their sons, and threatened to punish any that should be found to have transgressed his injunction. He also appointed overseers who should compel them to do what he commanded. And indeed, many Jews complied with the king's commands, either voluntarily or out of fear of the penalty that it was denounced. But the best men and those of the noblest souls did not regard him, but did pay a greater respect to the customs of their country than concern as to the punishment which he threatened to the disobedient. On which account, they every day underwent great miseries and bitter torments, for they were whipped with rods, and their bodies were torn to pieces, and were crucified, while they were still alive and breathed. They also strangled those women and their sons, whom they had circumcised, as the king had appointed, hanging their sons about their necks, as they were upon the crosses. And if there were any sacred book of the law found, it was destroyed. And those with whom they were found miserably perished also. And of course, we could read more about this matter, but I think that probably is sufficient to let you see that Daniel knew a long time ahead of time what would happen, and pictured in his writings, which we had just read, virtually the same thing we have read from these secular histories. So Epiphanes comes on the scene, and he is a man who has done all kind of things, as record of history tells us, against God, his people, and against those matters which pertain to the truth and righteousness. But then it says that this man's going to have a duration of 2,300 days. Now, in Bible prophecy, it is very easy for us to confuse sometimes days and years and other ways of counting. And sometimes we perhaps wonder why we're able to take a certain point of view when others perhaps take a different point of view. Let me see if I can explain that for just a moment. There's no certainty at all about interpreting Bible time. You can remember perhaps that back in the time of the Old Testament, the king was allowed to have 15 more years Hezekiah to his life. Now, 15 years was 15 years. There was no question about it. It meant an exact 15 years. In Daniel 4, where we find Nebuchadnezzar had a punishment of 7 times, that was not 7 times something else. It was simply 7 times or 7 years. That was an exact 7 years. As you mentioned from Ezekiel chapter 4 last night, though, Ezekiel was told that there's a day for a year. Then when the children of Israel went into the promised land and returned after 40 days wandering to spy out the land, God told them you're going to spend 40 years wandering in this desert. So the matter of interpreting time has no pattern whatsoever. And the only way we can know for sure that we're right is allow the circumstances which surround it to give us an idea of what he's talking about, whether it's present or future, whether it has to do with actual days or prophetic days, actual years or prophetic years, actual months or prophetic months. And then later on, as we use history and back into it, we can see whether we're correct or not. Now, I think that God was very wise in doing this. He did not allow men to have some type of a way to break his code. And so God used various ways of doing this. Now, many people who've talked about what the 2,300 days are. And if we take 2,300 days to be 2,300 years, as it could well mean, if that's all we knew about it, we start back with the Seventh-day Adventists who believe that we start at 457 as a time to begin this count. And we may get to 457 tonight, too, but from a different point of view. 457 is where they say this started. And if you go 2,300 years or 456, you come up to 1844. 1844 is the time at which, so they say, the temple was to be cleansed and Christ was to reappear. Didn't happen. So since it didn't happen, they had to do some rethinking. And that's the problem with all of us who try to deal in prophecy. We find out we're humans. And they found out very quickly they were human. So they did the rethinking and they said, oh no, we made a mistake. Sure enough, this is the right date. And sure enough, the temple was cleansed. But the fact is, we thought the temple was on the earth. The temple was in heaven. And so God cleansed the temple in heaven, and so it fits exactly. You know, the problem with this is, I didn't know that God's temple in heaven had to be cleansed. Did you? I never have heard about heaven having pollution in it. Did you? So why should we have to clean the temple in heaven? Seems to me that somebody's mistaken there. Adam Clark, and he's an extremely good commentator. I like him very well. He was a Methodist in his background, but he's very thorough and correct on a number of things, except this. He starts it at 334. And 2,300 years later comes to 1966. And he comes very, very close to some things. There are possibilities, but he's mistaken because nothing spectacular happened then that would fit this particular era of time. Oh, 334. I've forgotten now. Forgotten what it was. But anyway, he started it on some reasonable date, but he was mistaken. It didn't work out that way. Now, Brother P.C. Key, who was an extremely good Bible scholar, very good writer, a man who was very thorough in his reasoning, and Van Bonneau the same way. Both of those were extremely deep scholars and very fine men, but they had also views about this that I want to explain to you. Brother P.C. Key thought that 274, which was the date of one of the kings we're talking about, if we add 2,300 years to that date, comes up to 2022. Now, I'll talk about this probably tomorrow night in a little more detail, because in the meantime, he gives us the date of 1947, of 1977, and then he goes beyond that point and arrives again at 2022 twice. Very convincing argument, but the fact is, even though 1947 would have fit something that had to do with what we're going to talk about later on, the establishment of Israel, 1977 said absolutely nothing. And, of course, we haven't reached this yet. But the fact still remains, he's making the days into years. Now, Brother Van Bonneau says that the time to count began at 168 and ended at 165. Now, that's true because you're going backward in the B.C. era. And this would give us a time of 2,300 days. He says they are actual days, but if you look about three verses up from the end of that chapter, it says that there were evenings and mornings. And he says that in the Old Testament era of time, when you have the evening before the day, you have two sacrifices, morning and evening sacrifices. And so that really he's talking about this being divided into two because you have sacrifices evening and morning. So 2,300 days really means 2,300 sacrifices. So if you divide it by two, you come up with 1,150 days. But this is 3 years. That would be 3 times 360. That would be 1,180 days. Now, that, you see, wouldn't be the same as 1,150 days. Did I add that right? I didn't think I did. That'd be 1,080 days. So that wouldn't be the same as 1,150. So it doesn't work. Something there is just not fitting. Now, I think Brother Van Bonneau was on the right track. I think he almost had it right. But the fact is,
what his deduction is and what the Bible would require don't match. So that's not exactly right. He's almost right. Let's go a little farther now and see what we can find. You remember the first reading that I read to you? This was in the year 171, as the best knowledge we can gain from history. Now, that's a little vague, I'll have to admit. And August the 5th is not something you're going to read in history. I have never read it yet, but I'll tell you where I'll get that in just a moment. We turn to 171 as the time of the first reading, when Antiochus Epiphanes was returning from Egypt. Now, 2 years later, just a little over 2 years later, in 168, where he sent and did all the devastation, and you had the awful atrocities we read out just a moment ago. Now, 165 is where there was a restoring of the temple services, which I feel, and Brother P.C. Key, by the way, Brother Van Minow, by the way, feels, is the cleansing of the temple. And then in 164 is where Epiphanes dies an awful, terrible death. He says that no one can help him. He had an awful death, and he died just after the temple was restored to its original service. Now let's see if we can read some of those things that might allude to that. I don't believe I have it with me, but I'll give you the reference anyway to read. This is found in the book of Maccabees. Now, if you have an older Bible, or if you happen to have the Catholic version, you're going to find the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees in the middle of your Bible. If you don't have, you can buy that as a separate book at the store. Now, these are the books that our Catholic friends put between Malachi and Matthew, and those books do pretend to cover that era of time. And particularly, 1st Maccabees is an extremely good historical book about those events. It's like Josephus. It's a secular history. It's not inspired, but it talks about those times and gives you the details. And it tells us that on December the 20th, and by the way, Josephus does too, but on December 25th in 165, there was a restoration of the temple services as they had been before 171. What happened is that there was a man whose name was Mattathias. He was a man who had a number of children, and when these atrocities began to be done, and when he saw the Romans come in and all kind of havoc being wrecked among God's people, God's services, there was an order given to him and to his sons and those of his village that they would bow down and worship the gods of these outsiders. And he refused to do it and said that neither I nor my children nor anyone else here is going to serve your gods or bow down to you. Now, it's not known where that city is. It's been lost to history. But the fact is, history records the name of it. But at the time he was refusing, and they were having a conflict with a council from the Romans, a Jew who was loose in his thinking and perhaps afraid and saw fit to succumb to the false services and a false god for his own safety, pushed his way through and offered a sacrifice in front of Mattathias, his sons, and the people of the city. And with that in mind, Mattathias could not stand it. He ran the man through with a sword and very quickly turned on the officer who had come to give the orders and killed him too before the man knew what was going on. And of course, very quickly, there was a great revolt, so that Mattathias and his son Judas and others had to flee to the mountains. And a number followed them, and so you have a rebellion here in around Jerusalem. This continued to the point at which they had to be refugees in the hills. And histories tell us they lived like animals, living off the land and doing what they could, but they constantly fought the enemies of God and His purpose and His services. Eventually, the old man, after making a lot of havoc on the enemies of God's people, died. And his son, Judas, was appointed by him to take his place. And that took the name of Maccabees. So you might read of the name Judas Maccabeus several times in history. Maccabeus is a word that means the hammer of God. And that's what they claim to be. They claim to be God's hammer to bring justice and to restore God's temple to what it ought to be. This continued on for quite some time. Very interesting history. I don't have time to tell you about all of it. One simple thing I want to tell you is that in one of the battles, one of the Maccabean brothers And, of course, that was not their name, just the name they took. One of the brothers in a battle saw one of whom he thought was the king sitting on an elephant in the battle. Had apparently royal array, looked like he would be the king, and so he took a spear and ran through the army, ran through his enemies up to the beast, and stuck the spear in the stomach of the elephant to bring him down so he could kill the king. Well, as it happened, the elephant fell on him and crushed him to death. And the problem is, it wasn't the king after all. But anyway, history records his valiance in trying to do that. But in due time, they were successful in that the Romans have come on the scene. The Romans now are pushing back Antiochus and those that serve with him. They see their days are numbered and doomed. And the Maccabeans and others come in now on December 25th in 165. They found the temple desecrated. They found it in ruins. They found weeds growing up there. And then on that day, they cleaned it up. They put it back in order as it should have been. They tore down the old altar and built a new altar with stones that had not been touched by steel or by iron. And so once again, the service of God continues. Now watch what we do. If we go December 25th, and this is what Josephus tells us, of 165, and go back up to 171, to December 25th, 171, when the temple was first desecrated, we have 360 days between those years, between these years, between 7 and 8, between 8 and 9, between 9 and 10, between 10 and 1. So we have 6 years of 360 days each. Now what would that be? Let's see. That'd be 2,100 days. Now, we don't know the exact month or day in 171 when this occurred. We've already gone up to December 25th, but we don't know how much farther than that because all we know is a year. But if we add to this what is necessary to bring it up to 2,300, we come up to the date of August the 5th, 171. So that fits. If it's the circumstances, there's no quibbling about the date as far as how to evaluate the days or the timing, because we're not talking about a long expanse of time. We're not talking about some event way down in the future, 2,000 years. We're talking what happens at that time to those people, to the situation before Christ came, as you'll see in chapter 9. So it seems to me that we have here pretty well the time we're talking about. Between 165 and 171 tomorrow, Lord willing, we'll find out about what happened in 164. That, I think, brings us to a fitting conclusion of what was taking place in Daniel 8. I would love to go further. We have so much more to read and talk about on that, but I'm sure the time just can't allow that to be done. Turn, if you would, very quickly now to the book of Daniel chapter 9, and we'll proceed to, I hope rapidly, talk about some of those things we find there. Chapter 9 is a very lovely, lovely chapter. It gives us one of the most intriguing proofs that the Bible is true and that whoever wrote it, and I'm talking about God being the author of it, could not possibly have been a man. No man could have dreamed such a thing as this. Verse 1 says, "In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the seed of the Medes, which was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by books the number of the years whereof the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in desolations of Jerusalem." And we found that Jerusalem went into bondage in 587. So in 517, he says they were to have returned. They hadn't returned yet. In 517, they were to have returned. He goes on down in that same chapter and tells us about other things that are important. But let me notice this to you, that in several places you find a prediction of the 70 years captivity. One of those is in 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verse 21. The other is Jeremiah 25, verse 8 through 12. The other is Jeremiah 29, verse 10. Zechariah chapter 1, verse 12. Zechariah 7, verse 4 through 7. I'll give you those after services because our time's flying. In the same situation, we find that Daniel now confesses to God the sins of the people and the problems which they face. He says in verse 7, "Because of their transgressions that they have transgressed against God," he's appealing. He says, "Because we have sinned against thee," verse 8, "because we have sinned against him," verse 11, "for we obey not his voice," verse 14, "we have sinned, we have done wickedly," verse 15, "and because for our sins and for the iniquities of our fathers," verse 16. So Daniel now is appealing to God and telling him that he's aware of and apologizing for and trying to turn the hearts of the people back to God in view of their sins. So in this first part of chapter 9, Daniel confesses the sins of his people, and he requests God's mercy for them in verse 20. Now in verse 23, we have a prediction which is lovely to look at and marvelous to understand. And while I was speaking and praying and confessing my sins and sins of my people, Israel, and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain of my God, yes, whilst I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, began being caused to fly swiftly, touched to me about the time of the evening oblation. And he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give thee skill and understanding. At the beginning of thy supplications, the commandment came forth, and I am come to show thee, for thou art greatly beloved. Therefore, consider, understand the matter, and consider the vision. Now, verse 24, we have an introduction to for us already of something important about to occur. Verse 24 now begins to tell us what Daniel is to know and understand, and what to you and me is extremely important. As we consider this, and as we tie in the things we've already learned, and as we tie in later on things that we have yet to learn from Daniel in Revelation, we're going to see. I don't mean to be cocky. I don't mean for us to be overconfident, because we shouldn't be. We ought to be humble and appreciative. But we're going to see there's no doubt whatsoever about where we stand in God's sight. As a people, as a practice, as a movement of truth. All we're talking about confirms without a shadow of a doubt that we do have truth and stand properly before God. I don't mean by that we have all truth, because I haven't learned everything yet I like to know. We still have some things we need to learn and understand. But as far as our position is concerned, as far as the relationship we have with one another and with God, as far as the realm of identity which we have, there's no question at all about our having truth. I say that confidently, not cocky. And we're going to find that the books of Daniel and Revelation confirm that without a shadow. And tonight you're going to see that a little further. Verse 24 begins the prediction. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, and to make reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to heal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. A lot of things are contained here. He says, first of all, that we have 70 weeks under consideration. Now, we have mentioned that sometimes in prophecy, you deal with an actual number without any question about trying to understand what it means. Sometimes it has to do with days, sometimes years, sometimes centuries. Now, we notice here that we have 70 weeks under consideration. Now, if these 70 weeks are actual weeks, then, of course, we know that if we multiply it by 7, we're going to come up with 490 days. And if this pertains to the year, that is, a day for a year in actual time, then we have 490 years under consideration. And in a moment, it'll become clear that we're talking about years. So this line purports to be 490 years. I don't know where to start it, because he didn't tell me. I don't know where to end it, because he didn't tell me. All I know of is that this is 490 years. He says, now this is the time of consideration. He says, it's determined upon thy people. So this has to be upon the people of God, and upon thy holy city. This has to do with Jerusalem, and the people, and the area, and the situation, and the effect of what this city has to do to make the to finish the transgression. Now, what is the transgression? Well, of course, sin is a transgression of law. And the transgression of God's law began when? The Garden of Eden. Now, that's when transgression began. That's the first sin which ever confronted human life, the Garden of Eden. So whatever started there, he said, is going to be finished. And notice, he didn't say that sin's going to end or there'll be no more sin, but there's going to be a satisfactory conclusion for sin. So whatever sin started, it now is going to have a satisfactory end to it. and to make an end of sins. Again, sins won't end, but there's going to be an end, a satisfactory end, that can be accomplished in sinning. So that wherever sin started, and there was no solution for it, now there will be a solution for sin. And to make reconciliation for iniquity. What's reconciliation mean? Well, you have a husband and wife, and she doesn't cook the biscuits right, or something happens. He doesn't bring home what he ought to from the store. And so somebody doesn't like it. And so they don't speak to each other for a while. But the husband finally gets fed up. He calls on the phone, or he knocks on the door, or he knocks on the bedroom door. He says, "Honey, see that I'm wrong. I shouldn't have done that." And so she said, "All right, I'll forgive you." She said, she says, "I was wrong too. I shouldn't have acted like I did." So they're reconciled. It simply means they had a problem. Now they've come back together again. They had a disagreement. Now they have an agreement. So there was a need for reconciliation. Because you see, man and God parted in the Garden of Eden. Man left God. Now God is trying to make some way for man to come back to God so there'll be reconciliation of the problem that divided them. And to bring in everlasting righteousness. So whatever happens has to do with the effect of eternity. And to seal up the vision and prophecy. So whenever this happens, then this vision we're looking at now is going to be completed. And to anoint the Most Holy. So the Most Holy is the object of which we're speaking. And in the next verse, you'll find out who that was. Know therefore and understand. So 490 years is a time span he's talking about. We don't know when to start or when to end, but we know that when this time is ended, we will have found something extremely important because he's already told us, verse 24, that it's going to be that way. Now, verse 25 tells us how to determine when this time is. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem, unto the Messiah, the Prince, shall be. So he's telling us now when to look for the beginning. Know and understand that from the commandment. Now the commandment, and I'm not going to say all this tonight because it just would take too long, but there are a number of commandments to restore and rebuild in the books of Ezra and books related. Because you see, the city was destroyed in 587. The temple was destroyed in 587. And it must be rebuilt. Now it has already been rebuilt in the 500s that we were speaking about a while ago. On down to the 100s, we're talking about the rebuilt temple. So you and I know it has already been rebuilt at that time. But at the time of Daniel, it had not been. So the temple was destroyed in 587, and there was a commandment for it to be rebuilt and for the city to be rebuilt. And a number of times it talks about the rebuilding of the temple. But look at that verse again. It says, "Know and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem." Now, we're not talking about the temple. Now, a number of commentators on the Bible will tell you this is talking about the restoration of the temple and give the commands of where that is stated, but he didn't say that. Look again at it. He says the building, rebuilding of the city. So, this could not be 517 when the temple was rebuilt because they're not talking about the temple. Now, the temple was rebuilt in the days prior to Ezra. And Ezra returned with the multitude of the people. But left behind was a man whose name was Nehemiah. And Nehemiah, which is a book which follows Ezra and right before Esther, Nehemiah was a cupbearer to the king. Chapter 1 of Nehemiah tells you about this, and chapter 2 likewise mentions it again. And one day when he came before the king, the Bible tells us there that he was not in his normal self. He was not like he had been. His countenance was fallen, and he just did not have the appearance the king had been used to seeing him with. And so the king asked him, in effect, what's wrong? And he says, "I cannot be happy because I reflect upon my people and upon my city, and it's in ruin." And he's concerned about the land that he knew and about the people he loved and about the fact that where he is now, and even though he's bearing the cup before the king, even though things are well with him, he remembers the times like it used to be and like he had hoped to go back to. So he tells the king about his plight. Verse 1. "And it came to pass in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes." Now, if you go to your secular history and find out when Artaxerxes began to reign, you'll find out that that was in 477. Now, for the first time, we have a date. So, when Artaxerxes began to reign in 477, it says this was the 20th year of it. So, if I deduct 20 years from 477, I come up with 457. Well, with that in mind now, I can erase my question mark. Because I know when that command was issued. It goes on down here and tells us now that Artaxerxes commanded Nehemiah to go back and restore the city, build the city, and gave him all he needed to accomplish that purpose. So I have a date. 457. Now, if I know I have to have 490 years, and if I know that I start at 457, and I go beyond the year zero, because I'm going from BC to AD, that brings me up to 33 AD. So I can erase this question mark. I know that whatever I'm talking about now has to end in 33. So we're narrowing down our problem a little bit. Can you imagine God giving this to us? How did he know all this? How did he know to tell Daniel about this? You know, maybe just because he's divine. And maybe this book is not quite so far-fetched as some people think it is. Just maybe God wrote this book. Reckon? Had a discussion this Sunday before I came up here with a man who wasn't sure there was a God. He said, I have some kids at home. He said, I want to raise those kids right. He said, I might be wrong. And I want to know whether there's God or not, because if there is, I want to point them toward God. We had a long discussion. I hope we baptize him before long. I think we will. And his wife and children too. 457 is where we start. 33 is where we end. Apparently. Now let's go back to the book of Daniel again, chapter 9. He says, from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem unto the Messiah. So that's who we're talking about. The Messiah, which means the sent one. In English, it's Savior. In Greek, it's Christos. In Hebrew, it's Messiah. Same person. We're talking about Jesus. He says, the Messiah, the prince, he says, from that commandment shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. So we have a period, first of all, of 7 weeks, for 7 times 7, give us 49 years. So there's a time element there, which most people think it means it took this long to rebuild a city. The Bible does not say that, but most historians think that. Then it says 62 weeks. So 62 weeks times 7 days or 7 years in that yearly week would bring us up to 434 years. Now, if we add 49 years and 434 years together, how much does that bring us up to? 483 years. So we know then, we've come up here of our 490 year period, we have come up to 483 years of it. All in the world he's trying to do is just get rid of some time so he can put the focus on the last end of it. That's all he's doing. He knows he's telling Daniel it's a long way in the future when it's going to occur, and don't look for things for quite some time. But after this time, something's going to occur. Now we take 483 from 490 possible years, we have 7 years left. You see, if it was 490 years, we've accounted for 483 of those, we know we have 7 years left before we get to 33. Now continue on. Verse 26. And after 62 weeks, that is, after this period here comes an end, after this section of time has been reached, after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off. So after this time, not before, but after this time, Christ is going to be crucified. But not for himself. You see, this confirms even again the fact that Christ did not come to die for himself. He had no sin. He died for us. Therefore, he's dying not for himself. And this is important. The prince of the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Not that we're rebuilding it. We are. But you see what Daniel's doing? This is extremely important, because some of your friends don't know this, and they need to know it when you discuss with them about the 70 weeks of Daniel. The temple here is commanded to be rebuilt. Hadn't been rebuilt yet, you see. So it could not have been before 457. Then he says, the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city. It's been rebuilt. And now, way out here somewhere, somebody's going to come again and destroy it after it's rebuilt. Now, the next time the city was destroyed was in 70 A.D. He's plainly telling us here Now, whatever's going to occur has to occur after 4:57, has to occur after whatever this time is. And what is that time? Well, if we take 4:57 and 4:90 and 4:83 and realize we have 7 years left, that brings us up to 26 A.D. So the event we're talking about has to occur after 26, but before 70. Because 70 A.D. is when a new army is coming in. The city is going to be destroyed again, and it won't be there for this to occur. So the coming of Christ, the building of his church, had to occur before 70 A.D. Now, many of our friends who say it hasn't come yet, many of them think Christ is going to come in his kingdom around 1,000 years, but this tells us it had to occur before 70 A.D. So if it hasn't happened yet, then the Bible's wrong. Now notice again. After 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself, and the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. That's the Romans. And they came with Titus at the head of the army in 70 A.D. and destroyed again, as Christ said they would do in Matthew 24 and Luke 21. And the end thereof shall be the flood, and unto the end of the war desolation is determined. Awful time was going to occur. In fact, as we're talking to Brother Jim today, in the book of Josephus, which is right here on my left-hand side, and I don't have time to read it, we have a record of atrocities done, and there even women boiled their own children and ate them. It was that desolate in that town. Desolation and harm and problems were everywhere, and the Jews were slaughtered. And from that time, they were scattered throughout the world and never returned again as people until 1948. But notice, verse 27, and he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. So you see, we've come up to this last week of time. This 1 week is what's under consideration. And what he's been telling us now has really been to point our attention upon 1 week. That's all he's been telling us right now. He's trying to point us to this. But there are some who say, oh, no, no, no. Now, we come up to 26 AD, that's right. But this week is way out in the future somewhere and hasn't occurred yet. It's way out there. Now, that's not far-fetched because a number of people around us teach you that. A number of books and magazines will have that in there. This 70 weeks of Daniel has 69 weeks to complete right here. Now watch. You add your 7 and your 62, you get 69. And they'll agree on all this up to 69, but the 7th week is way out there and hadn't happened yet. And when it happens, Christ is going to come back to this earth and set up his kingdom and reign 1,000 years on it. Did I miss something? Did it sound about 1,000 years here? It didn't. What about a long period of time before that 70th week comes? Did I miss that? Is it there? I don't think I missed it, did I? If I read it right, it didn't say anything about it. So it just must not be there. For us to go over to Revelation now and take 1,000 years and bring back over to Daniel and insert it here is to tamper with the truth. It's just not there. He tells us there are going to be 70 weeks. He accounts for 69 of those and says, in that next week is what we're looking for. He shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. In the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. In the midst of the week. What's the middle of the week? Evan? How many days are in a week? What's it start with? And end with? Okay, what would the middle day be? Okay, you start with Sunday, you end with Saturday, you have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So you said the middle week, middle of the day would be Wednesday. That means you have 1, 2, 3 days on that side, and 1, 2, 3 days on that side. That's right, isn't it? Now, if we have a 7-day week of years, that would mean how many years, Evan? How many would you think? 3.5 and 3.5, that's right. So you have 3.5 on this side because you see Wednesday divided into 2. You have 3.5 on this side. Now, if we have a week of years and something happens right in the middle of it, It happened 3.5 years after it began, and then 3.5 years after it left over. So 3.5 years after 26 brings us up to the year 29.5. We're not talking about months, so I'm just going to round that off to 30 A.D. just to give you a number to keep in mind. 30 A.D. Now, what happened to 30 A.D.? He said, he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. In the midst of the week, he shall cause a sacrifice and the oblation to cease. Now, if you read Hebrews 8, 9, and 10, if you go back to the books in the Old Testament of Leviticus and Deuteronomy, you'll find that these sacrifices were to be enacted and done continually from the time of the law of Moses until they were fulfilled in the coming of Jesus Christ. Galatians chapter 3 tells us in a beautiful way that when Christ came, these things ceased. The old law was effective and good until that time, and then it had served its purpose and it faded away. For some 1,500 years, the sacrifice and the oblation was made. By what? The blood of bulls and of goats. They could not take away sin, Hebrews tells us. Therefore, they had to have something instead of bulls and goats to shed its blood to take away our sins. And that was the pure Lamb of God. And thus, when Christ died, he took away these sacrifices and the oblations, which they offered year by year continually, because they could not make the coming thereunto perfect. But when Christ came, he did. Thus, when Christ came, he took away the sacrifices and oblation by fulfilling those, and died himself in our stead, and never again can we expect another sacrifice to be made for us and shed blood, for Christ paid it all, for the times past and the times future. And for the overspreading of abomination, he shall make it desolate, even to the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. So when Jerusalem is destroyed this next time, it's going to be an awful thing, but the Messiah will have come. And then to confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, let's just know that the Jews were ushered into God's kingdom in Acts 2. The Gentiles were ushered in Acts 10 in the year 33 A.D. Thus we have Christ coming on the scene, dying on the cross, and the church being established in 30 A.D. 486 years after the prediction of Daniel in chapter 9. Don't know how long I've talked. I've talked a long time and you know it. But you've been extremely kind to listen, and I appreciate so much you allowing me to take this extra time tonight. I hope that you know as I do it was worth it, because we needed to see these marvelous truths given to us by God. I thrill at these studies. I learn more than most anybody does about it because I have to do the studying on it. And I'm thrilled to do it. And I'm just so thrilled that you come to share with us in these studies and you are here tonight. I don't know your hearts, of course, and you don't know mine. But we know each other. But we know our own. And I wonder if by seeing these things we've talked about so far this week, and you're not in the Lord's church, you don't have Christ as your Savior, perhaps not living the life that you should, I wonder if it hasn't pricked your attention to wonder if I shouldn't make a change. If God is able, through the thousands of years of time, point out these things, some of the little bitty details like we talked about tonight, if God is able to see and to know all of those things and give those to us in such marvelous ways, surely that God ought to be served and honored and obeyed. And surely the promises he makes are genuine and lovely and valuable. Shouldn't we give more thought, more serious thought than we ever have, about submitting ourselves to our Creator, to our God, and to our Savior? Why don't we make that choice tonight? Make our way sure before God while we stand and sing.
Number 648.